it's a pleasure to be sitting in with you on Sunday night. It's a kick. And actually, it's when you keep a daytime schedule, it's really easier to do two in a row than it is to do one in a row. Because, you know, if you, depending on what time zone you're in, you're off the air early Sunday morning. And then on Monday, then it really hits you. But somehow or another, when you do two in a row, it's just fine. Anybody who's ever done it knows exactly what I mean. All right, let's have a couple of fascinating messages of a commercial nature targeting you by our beloved sponsors. And then get right back with David Brin on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. So, David, you were saying that there are, was it five distinct possibilities of at least an environment that would theoretically, at least according to our understanding of what life is, that said life could be supported by these places. You mentioned a moon on orbiting Jupiter, and then another one, I forgot it, Europa was one, and then another one.
We're learning more and more about both our solar system and beyond our solar system, and the most exciting place isn't Mars. Although that's cool, I got on the list to maybe go. But
did you really? Excellent.
Oh, yeah, I signed up for that. But the thing is, well, we can talk about that too, but the there are other places in our solar system that probably have liquid water and therefore might be conducive to life. And the two that we're pretty darn sure of are Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. The ice that's prevalent out there gets melted because Europa is pretty close to Jupiter, and the tides flex Europa and make it the water melt. But on the surface, it's facing the cold of space, so the top, you know, kilometer or so is ice protecting this ocean below. So if life ever evolved there, it wouldn't have any concept of the sky. It wouldn't know that space was out there. It wouldn't know about the stars. And the same is true of a moon of Saturn called Enceladus. Our Cassini space probe there has seen geysers of liquid water sprayed out from Enceladus. So maybe there are oases and gaps where the Enceladans might actually see the sky briefly. But, you know, and there are at least three other, possibly even 10 other moons and asteroids in our solar system that might have these little pools of potential life-friendly zones underneath their surface. And the universe may be filled with them. So then the question comes back to, you know, where the heck is everybody?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you make all these photographs? You know, Richard Hoagland, a frequent guest on the program, has been for years and years and years. He was really excited about some of the photographs that were coming back from the various rovers up there. And I mean, I'm not so sure that those are apartment complex remains that we're seeing, but I'm not going to say they aren't either. I'm not up there. It's like, well, I'll be darned. It really is an apartment complex. And look, there's the pool over there. I mean, I don't know. I'm not up there. But what do you make of all that stuff?
Dick Hoagland has been around for a long time, and we were speaking earlier of pattern recognition, where you can see confirmation bias. You can see confirmation of what you want to see there. And that's why science developed the system of being a very highly competitive field. Some of the mass media are spreading terrible slanders about scientists, for instance, that they're all meek little lemmings all squirreling around for teensy little climate grants and all saying exactly the same thing. Well, they don't know the scientists I've known who would, if it weren't illegal, gun each other down in a dark alley. The science is an extremely competitive field, and the young Turks, the young guns in science, those who just recently got tenure and a good grant studying one thing, they're constantly looking out for something else to study to go toppling some theory or toppling some. So when science reaches a consensus about a model of the world, that doesn't mean it's permanent, but it does mean that it is the best current model of the world. And believe me, if there were any serious reasons to believe that some photograph was showing something worth investigating, even if two-thirds of the scientists were going poo-poo, believe me, there'd be plenty who'd be saying, you know, I want to target, you know, telescope time. I want to equip the next rover to go and do this. How many of you out in the audience out there remember Network, the movie Network? Do you remember, John, where that wonderful scene where the crazy news announcer says to the entire nation, I want you to get up now, and I want you to go to the window. And
I'm mad as hell.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. It's a wonderful scene. But you'll see how resonant that is with the self-righteousness addiction. And I'm not saying that we don't have things to be mad as hell about, but it's really easy to cater to that. Well, let me tell you what I did when the Curiosity lander landed on Mars a year ago. And I was, you know, watching with my kids, and I was explaining to them what the mission control guys were saying. They were saying the complicated engineering language, and I was saying, that means the aeroshell let loose. That means the parachute has been... So I was giving them play-by-play. And what we witnessed was a fully functioning robot laboratory on wheels that was lowered gently to the surface of Mars at the end of a crane that was suspended from a hovering rocket that had been lowered by a parachute that had been threaded onto the planet by an aero-braking shell, atmospheric entry shell, that had been fired so close to where it belonged that it was completely on target after crossing 50 million miles. It's like shooting a bullet to snuff a candle in New York City from L.A. And I got up, and I went to the window, just like in the movie Network, and I screamed. My kids were surprised. I screamed, I'm proud as hell, and I'm a member of a civilization that can do shit like this. That we can do stuff like that? The only thing that was more surprising to me is how few people went to the window at that point and shouted their joy.
Right.
And you listeners out there, are you so mired in anger that you're not able to notice stuff like that? And yes, there's tons of stuff we can talk about that we need to improve. Edward Snowden revealed a whole lot of things we can discuss. You know, I wrote a book called The Transparent Society about...
What do you think about him? What do you think about him, David? You think he's a hero, or you think he's a traitor, horrible traitor?
Neither. Look, I fly back east and consult with government agencies all the time because there are some government agencies that are smart enough to know they need to bring a sci-fi author every now and then. And they'd like to bring in, there's about a dozen of us scientific science fiction authors, and they say, well, what about this? What about that? Because we look a little farther ahead and we say, what if? What if this? And some of us are informed by science and technology as well. I was an engineer. But the thing is, I tell them whenever I go back east, I say, look, you need tactical secrecy in order to do your jobs, hunt down bad guys and all that sort of thing. I get that. And even Snowden got that. He redacted from the things he released, the things that he thought would actually damage their ability to do the job. And he released things that he thought would get a conversation going. And I think that's probably what happened. It was extremely arrogant of him to take it on himself to make that decision. But there are times when civilization benefits from an arrogant jerk. And in this case, the conversation badly needed to be started. Even though, and here's the huge irony of it all, Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, and of the three of them, by far, I most respect Snowden. When they revealed all the stuff that they revealed, it turns out they revealed almost nothing illegal. Almost nothing. But what we needed to do was discuss whether or not these things should be legal. And so I think he did us a service, but I think he also broke the law. And one of the things Gandhi and Martin Luther King pointed out is that if you're going to be a whistleblower, if you're going to be a person in civil disobedience on the basis of principle, then you have to expect that you may have to be punished and suffer the punishment as in the spirit of Gandhi. And I'm not saying Edward Snowden is Gandhi, by the way.
Right.
He gives every sign of being an egotistical prick. But the fact of the matter is we have a civilization that raises egotistical young men who don't have children, don't have families, and can take risks. I call them social T-cells. And this is the good side, or a somewhat terrible side, of that self-righteousness addiction that I spoke of earlier. You create an atmosphere of suspicion of authority, and guess what? Every now and then, some guy's level of tolerance is going to be exceeded, and he's going to feel that it's his mission to tell his fellow citizens about it. And even if he's wrong to have chosen that threshold, to have chosen this event or this thing to holler about, I tell these guys back east, CIA, NSA, all these guys, I tell them, get used to it. Because you're a member of a civilization that does this, that is high on the high of sanctimony and self-righteousness, and that has taught several generations to believe in suspicion of authority. You name for me a film that you've enjoyed across the last 40 years that didn't preach three main messages: tolerance, eccentricity, and above all, suspicion of authority. In most movies, the main character endears himself or herself to you by showing some kind of eccentric trait, and you find out who the villain is by some act of intolerance, and then comes the interaction between the main character and some abusive authority figure who has to be overcome. Even in chick flicks, the authority figure doesn't have red glowing eyes, but still, there's some authority figure who has to be taken on. And a lot of my audiences, there's always a few in the audience who get really ticked off at this point, because what I'm saying is we've been subjected to this incredibly intense, at least 50 years longer, propaganda campaign to have a reflex to hold authority in suspicion. And these guys do not like to hear that their suspicion of authority habit was something that they suckled like mother's milk from almost every aspect of popular culture. We like to think we invented it. And admit it, you guys out there, you like to think you invented suspicion of authority. But the biggest difference between a decent Republican and a decent Democrat, you know what that is? I'm talking about the grown-ups, the guys who are calm. The biggest difference between a calm, decent Republican and a calm, decent Democrat is this: which direction they face their suspicion of authority. A decent Republican is concerned about a Big Brother abuses by snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats. A decent Democrat is worried about Big Brother abuses and too much accumulation of power by conniving aristocrats and faceless corporations. And when you put it that way, the only real answer is, duh. I mean, they're both right that horrible abuses in Big Brother could come from either of those two directions. And when we're calm, what we're doing is dividing the labor. The Republican is saying to the Democrat, all right, look, I trust corporations and aristocrats more than you do, so I'm not going to aim my suspicion at them. You aim your suspicion at them and guard my back. I'm going to be holding accountable these academics over here, or these snooty intellectuals, or these government bureaucrats, because this is the direction that I'm paranoid about. And we'd be guarding each other's backs. That's the natural American synergy, and it's failed. And you know darn well why it's failed. It's failed because of this tsunami of self-righteousness that's being egged on by certain media interests that want us to fail, that don't want us to keep on succeeding the way we've been succeeding in this last American century.
Well, I think you bring up the media. I think that's one of the most dangerous components of the entire civilization, because nobody is going to come on as a news presenter and say, well, everybody got along today. No heinous acts on any level were committed. And as a matter of fact, it's partly cloudy with mostly sunshine. So we're going to cut immediately to our entertainment segment and good night. I mean, they have to keep it stirred up at all times. It doesn't matter.
I don't mind a certain amount of criticism and all that sort of thing. If, as long as we're aware that when you don't have something horrible and heinous, there's always some other problem you can show. But the thing is, if it's a more medium level problem that we can negotiate about, then you don't get the audience riled up. And getting them riled up is different than saying, this is a really interesting problem, and, you know, now we're going to hear from this one person who says that the problem should be answered 20% by government solutions and 80% by the free market, and his opponent is going to she's going to suggest that it should be 70% government and 30% free enterprise solutions. Well, that sounds awful darn nerdy. And who's going to actually sit and listen to that?
You know what, though? I keep going. Go ahead, finish your thought, and then I want to toss something out at you.
No, you go ahead, John.
Here's the thing. I get you. I really do. But I always default to things like the seven deadly sins, you know, revenge and sloth and lust and greed and gluttony and blah, blah. And people hate it when I say blah, blah, but I'm just saying, you know the list. And then also anybody who's ever decided, I'm going to study acting because I want to pursue that art. Well, you're going to study Greek theater, and the reason that you study it is because the stories never change. And at least the Greeks had enough sense to put masks on the on everybody so that, well, the bad guy really has better fashion sense, or, gee, you know, I really like the evil one a lot better. He or she is more handsome or prettier than the good guy. I don't care about Mr. and Ms. Goody Two-Shoes over there. I'm going to roll with the bad guy. Aren't we just inexorably drawn into conflict because we cannot break away from these things that just seem to be permanent components to our collective character? Well, collective and individual character.
Well, you sure opened a whole huge range of things to discuss. And one is, you know, just what are the common archetypes of storytelling across all civilizations? And one is that you need tension. You need danger. You need to put your hero in pulse-pounding jeopardy. And that's been the same across the ages. Joseph Campbell, in his books, The Hero's Journey, he talks about, you know, certain cycles of rhythm and drama that the characters go through. But I don't agree that nothing's changed in that the Greek plays, and by the way, I adore them. I think that, you know, I weep whenever I, you know, Oedipus has to face his inexorable fate. But that is the difference of the American storytelling tradition from the ancient Greeks, and that is that fate was inexorable in those days.
You know, that's a good one. All right, tell you what, when we come back, I want to discuss with you the difference between your view of the future. And I want to reference a science fiction writer forum that I conducted some months ago, and just get your take on all of that. We'll carry on with David Brin on Coast to Coast AM in just a moment. David, before we just jump into another break here, I got to ask you something. I conducted this thing I called the Science Fiction Phantasmagoria and brought on four science fiction writers. Three of them had multiple Hugos or Nebula Awards and so forth. And to my, and really, I wanted to bring them on the program to, because, you know, I had the privilege of interviewing Ray Bradbury in 2008. And he was just excellent, you know, and I just thought, you know, I read Fahrenheit 451 again, published in 1950, and I'm going, good grief, was this guy ever ahead of the curve? What? You know, these interactive TV screens and, you know, this really dissuasion of the population in general from doing the old sit around the front porch and talk and spend time, interact with your neighbors and so forth and just... And all of that, and all the while, the bombers are flying overhead in preparation for the inevitable next war. And then they eventually have to leave the city and go out and remember all of the knowledge. Because, you know, when the firemen show up, they take care of your books, and they take care of you, too, by setting them on fire along with yourself. And to my shock and amazement, the Italian guy was the most excited about the future and sort of trying to predict the future and where mankind might go. But the other three, I mean, the award winners were like, nah, we don't really believe in UFOs. Nah, we don't really believe in ETs. Nah, we don't really believe in life on other planets. And I thought, wow, I wonder if they have to stay in the realm of fantasy, because if they say, well, yeah, we do believe in all that stuff, then they would be writing more toward the nonfiction side of things than to the fiction side of things. It would be science nonfiction or some sort of a hybrid kind of a story. But you seem to deal with not only the future as far as, you know, the earthbound the earthlings and their existence here on the planet is concerned, but I mean, you were just talking about, say, there are several places out there that look like they really could support some life. So do you, as a science fiction author, in any way try to predict the future? I guess that's why the security services want to talk to you, because they think maybe you do have that bent.
Well, you know, that's a really, really big question. And in fact, science fiction authors don't really try to predict the future so much as they try to explore it. So, you know, when you come up with a good plot, you're asking, what if? And sometimes it can be, you know, like one of my more famous books, Star Tide Rising. Well, that's, what if we meddled in the genes of dolphins and gave them the power to be engineers and to fly spaceships, and so you have dolphins in space? Or what if our civilization collapsed, as I wrote about in The Postman? Might it be that we wouldn't have a Mad Max post-apocalyptic world, but rather one that started falling into feudalism? And then what would people who remembered the better times do? And it's that emotional aspect of it that Kevin Costner really captured, rather than the brains. He scooped out, threw away most of the brains from my book, but kept the heart, and I was grateful for that, at least. So, you know, there is a special kind of science fiction that doesn't try to predict the future, it tries to prevent it. And it's called the self-preventing prophecy. And the most powerful of those would be George Orwell's 1984. Because everyone who has ever read 1984 comes away from that book absolutely determined to do whatever they can to prevent it from ever happening. And millions of people have used the metaphor of Big Brother to say, I'm going to pose, I'm going to spend my life, at least part of my effort, part of my energy, part of my money, opposing the arrival of this terrible thing that chilled me in this story. And as we were talking about before the break, you know, if you're a conservative person, then you think Big Brother is going to come from academics or civil servants, and if you're a liberal person, then you think that it's going to come from the aristocrats who oppressed us with feudalism for 6,000 years, that they're coming back. But the main thing is it may very well be that we don't have Big Brother today because George Orwell wrote that book. And that's what's called the self-preventing prophecy. Air Force officers later admitted that Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe and some of those other warnings about nuclear war actually changed some of their procedures and may have saved us. That's powerful science fiction.
I'll say it is. All right. Well, I wanted to ask that question before we got too far afield. And we'll take our little floating, we call it a floating break. We're going to float away for about 2 minutes and come right back with you. David Brin, welcome back after 14 years. Good grief on Coast to Coast AM. Now, do I understand this correctly? Were you influenced by the work of John Brunner?
Well, I knew John only a little bit. I was very proud to know John Brunner because he was the scary science fiction writer of the 60s who was so on target and developed so many wonderful new techniques to explore our possible tomorrow. And Stand on Zanzibar was his
goal. Oh, yeah. Word. Read my mind. I've got a hard copy of that.
Oh, yeah, I modeled two of my novels. My 1990 novel, Earth, has a lot of internet-related things in it. It had web pages, you know, 2 years before there was a web, and the whole idea was to try to capture some of the feeling of excitement that you had in Stand on Zanzibar of the multimedia and the excitement of how rapid things might be in the future. And my most recent novel is called Existence. It's just been out for a year, and it goes back to that same business where you have multiple characters, and in between each chapter there's a little glimpse of the world, of the future, of the near future, and how augmented reality may affect us, or some of these things that people are talking about, the singularity, whether or not we might be headed towards creating artificial intelligence or new kinds of minds in our children, whether or not our children will be even like us in future days. So, one takes one's inspiration where one can get it.
You know, when that book came out in 68, there were 3.5 billion people on the planet. Look at us now.
Well, you know, there's good news, bad news. The bad news is that 7 billion is very difficult.
Yeah.
The good news is that never before has such a large percentage of the children on planet Earth had full bellies living in homes that have at least a little electricity, running water, and go to school every day. More than two-thirds of the kids on this planet are doing that now, and it's never been so high. But then you turn around, and the good news has bad news that goes with it, and that is it's harder to maintain a world filled with middle-class people with all their appetites and their spending and their consumption than it is, you know, if they were poor. But then you turn it around again, and there's a good side to that, and that is that middle-class people have fewer kids. The great miracle of humanity is that as soon as women got rights and they knew their children weren't going to die, women all over the world have said, I want somewhere between one and three kids. And in Russia, where they don't like their men very much, they're having one, and in some other countries, you know, it's the demographic collapse is happening more slowly, but that saved humanity. And the good news is that if you become middle class, you don't have to be quite as much of a burden on the earth as Americans are. Because we live in these huge houses and we have these big appetites because we were the first ones to become middle class. So we have these habits of just using everything in sight. But we know we're going to have to become more efficient. And if we're going to make everybody on Earth middle class, well, you know, we're going to have to find ways for them to be middle class really efficiently. like the Dutch or the Japanese, but even more efficient than that, because we're going to have 8 billion people with homes and electricity and sewers and being able to buy all the electronics they want. Well, it's going to have to be a more modest version of middle class than we were used to. The Earth won't be able to handle it.
This is the only thing that kind of, it's raising a little bit of a flag. I'm going to wax slightly challenging here, so let's just joust a little bit. Are you talking about the United States specifically? Because we seem to have our population to some degree under control with the, 2.3 children or whatever it is. But my question is, the rest of the world wants to be middle class. They want to enjoy, I don't know this, I'm speculating, but it appears that a good bit of the world, that's why they come to America. It's like, you can make money in America. We don't really like America, but we can make money in America. And it seems like we may not be producing this vast number of new babies, more children and so forth, but somebody is contributing to this, billion after billion persons in addition to the world population as time has gone by. So are you talking about America and containing our self-righteous indignation? We can just have all the space that we want and the house the size that we want it to be and just do and consume whatever we want? Or are we factoring in the rest of the world that seems to be very keen on emulating what they have seen us do since World War II?
Well, look, everyone has been watching our movies. They know how rich we are, and I don't think we're as hated as you implied. Look, the empire at any one time is always hated.
Well, I'm not saying that I think that we're hated. I think that they want to be like us. And what are we going to do to say, we made a mistake? You really don't want to be like us. What do we do about that?
Well, we're not saying that so much. When we tell them, we've been accused of finger wagging and lecturing people not to have what we have. And they, of course, they want what we have. But what's coming across is that they're going to have it more modestly than us. But we're moving in the same direction, too. This is the year that American homes are in transition to LED light bulbs because they've dropped in price enough so that their huge advantages, the incredibly less amount of electricity that they use, the much longer lifespan, it's reached the point where this medium-scale game changer has arrived, and people all over America are going to this year be swapping out, at least in their high traffic parts of their homes, they're going to be swapping out, paying the extra to get the LED bulbs. Well, that's part and parcel of the fact that because of the laws that required that our refrigerators and other appliances get more efficient with time. A couple of years ago, we finally passed the new efficiency laws for the cars, and it's working great. The result is that while we're finger-wagging and lecturing the rest of the world saying, okay, you're becoming middle class, that's great. We're doing that with trade and Walmart, you're working in the factories and your kids are going to school and you're becoming somewhat middle class. You're going to have to do it a whole lot more efficiently than we did because we were the first. And we're going to match you because we're going to become more efficient, too. Americans will always have the biggest houses because we're used to that. We've set up all these freeways and the streets and all that, so we're going to always have the big cars. But we can do it a lot more efficiently. And that's worth doing whether or not you believe in global warming. It's the word for that is TWODA, things we ought to do anyway. Most of the things that we need to do in order to help ease global climate change are things we ought to do anyway, just to become more efficient and save money.
Sure.
And this is an example of where the self-righteousness is blocking us from negotiating things. Let's say the scientists say we have to do this and such. Well, half of what they're asking us to do is stuff we should do anyway. So why aren't we at least negotiating about that half? And it's an example of where if we had the can-do spirit back and the negotiation back, that we would only be arguing over half the stuff that we're currently arguing over.
Would you agree that the... Go ahead, the other half.
Doing it.
No, you go ahead, the other half.
Well, the other half we'd have to argue. But that's what adults do. They argue. They don't scream. And we've gotten into the habit of being a nation of screamers. I'm wondering if this is even going to be solved before the baby boomer generation goes away. Because if there's one talent us boomers have, it's self-righteousness. And it wasn't always bad, by the way. We needed to march for civil rights. You know, we needed the women needed to burn bras and get our attention. But, you know, I look at my kids, and they're just so much calmer than us boomers. And maybe the best thing to do would be to hand things over to them.
Well, maybe it's because they've been able to divert their attention onto a flat screen to sort of supplant what we went through as the post-World War II generation, where it was like the threat of communist annihilation via atomic weaponry 1 minute. A draft. I mean, I'm just looking at what happened in the, 43, we're getting beat up pretty bad. 53, that was the end of the Korean War. 63, that was the end of John Kennedy. They took him clean out. Then, let's see what, 73, we're now into the Arab oil embargo. 83, I don't remember because I was there. 93 seemed to usher in a visible, government, oppression. You know, the whole Waco thing and the Oak City bombing soon followed and stuff like that. And I don't know, if I were to write a science fiction story now myself, I think it would probably be about the entire globe. It's almost like, I mentioned this the other night, I read a little thing by Jonathan Swift, and it was just, when nothing's worth defending, we build a magazine. Being the place where you store your ammunition and so forth. And it almost seems that we're headed that direction. I see a world that is in a complete surveillance grid. The United States Special Forces, Special Operations Command is now deployed in 100 countries around the world. And I'm going, what exactly are we doing here? We have a massive surveillance state, as foretold by Orwell. Huxley got into it a little bit. Information overload came from Brunner. You know, with the Gutenberg galaxy or whatever it was from McLuhan. And stuff like this. I mean, I just see this stuff rolling at us. And you combine this onslaught of apparatus operated by the authorities. Combine that with the division of ideology among the population. And I'm just thinking... Wow, this looks really stupid. In another 10 years, I have no idea what it'll look like. But it appears that it's going to be a completely... Talk about what's the name of your book? The Transparent Society? Absolutely. I mean, there was an article today about whether you're in the toilet or whether you're out in public at the airport, the security services are watching you. So, I mean, I'm...
And then the question that I raise in the Transparent Society, and there's a creepy Twilight Zone moment on page 206, where it seems that I predicted 9/11 and the Patriot Act. And, we can tell you all about that after the break.
All right, well, let's take the break then. And I look forward to it. I want to hear all about it. And anybody who would like to call, please do. We're going to take some calls in the next hour. There are two or three people on hold now, but we have... vast numbers of lines here, so you'll get in if you call. You know the numbers. If you don't, we'll play them for you. This is the Sunday night edition of Coast to Coast AM.